Welcome everyone to Fire and Water, the podcast. I'm Tennyson Wolfe. Glad to be here today for another episode of this podcast that I think of as trying to lift up a little of our basic ordinary humanness that has everything to do with how we go about living our lives, being our communities, doing our jobs, some of that kind of stuff. And I love having a guest. I so often think of in terms of having a guest that we're just going to have one of the regular conversations that we have, but we're going to record it and notice a few of the things that just connect quite deliberately into this very human to human thread. I'm excited today to have an old friend, an old buddy, an old brother, or a long-term brother in work and in lots of life stuff. I'm going to invite his voice in a minute, but I'm going to say a few things about him. It's Chris Corrigan joining today. Yay. And Chris and I have so many different threads of background here. As I'm saying, it is an old friendship. It's an old work colleagueship. There is some brothering that we have with one another. I feel like there's a deep co-learning that we have, Chris, that's gone over the years. And there's so many layers that might come out in some of our questions, conversations, wanders, and meanders today that have something to do with music and song and poetry and food and facilitation and learning and reading and play and silliness and seriousness. These are all things that I connect in with you. So with all of that said, I'll thump my heart just a couple of times here with my hand to say, hey, Christopher, it's good to see you here and continue our journey. Hey, yeah.
Oh, so good to see you too. It's always good to see you.
I appreciate that, Chris. And maybe to start us off, you know, just a little bit of helloing here. You and I have saved our own helloing with one another, not to do a big pre-show thing. So we get to have a little bit of that. I do think of this as a converse circly kind of space.
Conversation. You are the master of neologisms.
Fake words. What did you call that? Wait, what's it called?
Neologisms, new words.
There we go. That's right. Oh, yeah, I love playing with those kinds of things to evolve who we are. But, you know, it's a question just of the showing up piece, Chris. How's it going today? Who are you? What's it like to be you today? What's some of that for you as you show up? Or what's some of the you that you'd like to bring into this space of our recorded little call here today?
I love that you asked that question. What's it like to be you? That's like one of those Tennyson questions. I think I've got like a little pocket full of Tennyson questions, you know, like what's the simplest thing I can do right now? Or what's it like to be you? Or like these are these, I mean, I pull that one out all the time as well. Cause it's not just how you doing, what's up? It's like, what's it like to be you? And it's a particularly beautiful thing I appreciate about you is that you invite us into depth, like even in the easiest way, like it's just one little trick. What's it like to be you? Like I could answer the question by saying, hey, it's a beautiful day here, it's really nice, I'm looking out at the Pacific Ocean near Vancouver where I live, and you know, there's humpback whales out there I'm hoping to see, but what's it like to be me? At the moment, it's kind of a joyful thing. I would say, like, I've been answering questions like that during and since the pandemic as like, it's been a good stretch, or it's been a challenging stretch, or, you know, it's been a really crappy stretch that I've been in, but actually it's been a really good stretch the last little bit, and just really appreciating things both big and small. I'm doing some stuff that feels like it's really significant. I'm recalibrating my work a little bit in a Tennysonian way towards some sort of simplicity and what I know how to do well, and really choosing to support people with that. So what it's like to be me right now is someone who's like reexamining his practice in the world, finding ways to challenge myself and learning things like jazz guitar and stuff like that. And then finding places I can celebrate and contribute to. And I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about it. Soccer season's on right now, and that's a big piece of that. But the But what it's like to be me right now is it somebody who's appreciating joy and goodness and beauty in big and small ways at the moment. Yeah. And noticing it, I think, in reciprocity, not just consuming it, not like I'm watching the world as a TV show, but more like I'm actually feeling like it's I think appreciating how it's activated by being in a reciprocal relationship with people and space and land and spirit, let's say. Let's go there.
Love it, Chris. Thanks for all the affirmations on this kind of question, because I have memory of this question coming from you also. So speaking of reciprocation or mutuality, there's some of that, we're
That's
all
funny.
drawing from some of the same things, but maybe, drawing from some of the courage or clarity that we ask. Because I remember a particular time when we were together and some shape of this question was coming out, and I remember distinctly your voice on it and a bit of your tone on it. And it was something like, how did you become you? And so that one, touches a similar
Hey,
space.
what's it like to be you, buddy?
What's it like to be me in this moment? Sure. I'll play
Yeah.
with that because that's how we do things. I feel the joy of sitting together this way, Chris, which has been true over the years here. Like there's a certain amount of laughter, silliness, playfulness, maybe it's lovingness also that just comes out of such a good friendship and a history too, because we've done a few things and we've shared a few things over the years. So I think there's a part of me that feels the joy in the moment. What's it like for to be me right now? It's a little bit of the joy in the moment because I'm on a Zoom call, a recorded call with my buddy Chris. And yeah, I like being buddies, I like developing buddiness together. Relating a lot to what you're describing. Uh-oh, lost you. Pause. Okay. There we go. So now we're resuming recording. Had a little glitch there, a little power thing that happened.
Little power outage on Bowen Island.
Yeah. Go figure. Well, and maybe that's part of what we've been doing over the years too. What's it like to be me? There's some adapting to the things that happen, and I like to think adapting in mostly graceful ways, but sometimes knowing that it's not graceful ways also. So,
Yeah, and then sometimes 10, we just knock the lights out, so.
yeah, right. There you go. I used to love that. You and I have a shared love and affiliation with Toka Mueller in Denmark, and back in some of the earlier Art of Hosting days that we all shared together. I remember that back in those days, we had a little bit of a pattern of bringing out some principles, like are there principles that guide us in the time that we have together? And we'd invite people to name some of those. And Toka was one that would name, and don't forget rule 6A, don't take yourself so fucking seriously. And rule 6B, as I remember it, was don't take others so fucking seriously. It was a lot of fun to be with people that could be like intensely purposeful and, oh gosh, let's laugh it up a little bit here too. Like let's bring a little of that sort of sarcastic irreverence or purposeful gesturing also with one another. That's another theme, I think, that
Yeah.
just lives between us or with us,
Yeah, agreed. Totally. Make me smile thinking of Toker.
So, in the theme of joy, Chris, can you name a few examples? What are you seeing? What are you drawn to? Little and big.
Good one. Yeah. I have a It's interesting. This year, I have a contemplative practice rooted in contemplative Christianity, and Christianity Lent is a big deal in most Christian denominations, right? So you spend all of this time sort of focusing on what you want to let go of, or establishing new patterns, and just it's a really focused to think about spiritual journey and everything. And it occurred to me that, I think Lent is like 40 days long. So it's this kind of 40 days of
what do I need to get rid of? What do I need to stop doing? What can I practice there? Sort of whether it's a fast, a spiritual fast or a physical fast or whatever it is. For me, it was sort of a social media fast again this year. And then what happens in the Christian tradition is like Easter happens and there's one day, it's like, yay. And then you kind of go back to your life. And it occurred to me that that doesn't seem like a very good balance, that we spend 40 days like working through hard stuff, but we don't get to spend the 50 days of Easter, because liturgically it's this long season, the 50 days of Easter celebrating new life, celebrating new things, bringing, letting stuff come, as Otto Scharmer would say, right? Why would you spend 40 days on the letting go and just one day on letting come? So this year I've adopted 50 days of like just sitting and watching for joy and watching for, however you want to call it, resurrection or new life or where kind of spirit is working. And it's funny because we don't talk publicly about this kind of stuff all the time, but it feels right to have that balance. 40 days of this, 50 days of that. Like, I just add another 10. Like, don't make it a complete balance. Tip the scales a bit. So this year, it's really been about noticing rather than making joy. It's not like forcing it. It's just turning our eyes to what is actually around us. So locally here on our little island, we've had a, as small communities do, we've had a big controversial decision that's being made to convert some land into parkland here and maybe have some camping, and lots of people are polarized around it. And that's, in small communities, it can get pretty divisive. And, I know folks, if we're talking to an American audience, you understand all of this. It's not that common in Canada in that same way, but in small communities, yeah, you definitely get it and you feel it. And so, part of what I've been doing is just posting on our community Facebook page, like things like, holy cow, that wind last night was so strong. There were white caps on Killarney Lake like I'd never seen before. Or, there's 30 sea lions piled up on a dock at the Cape right now. Or, just like little things, moments of kindness that I saw. And it's almost like it's like hacking the system. It's like hacking the narrative and just throwing things in there that are irrelevant to the conversation of the day. But they're completely relevant to what's happening on Bowen, on Bowen Island, on Nuklealakeag, where we live. And so it's been this process of just like observing all of this stuff and stopping long enough to see it everywhere. And I think for whatever reason right now, we're in a world where we're not noticing those small moments of joy a whole lot. Like, it's really easy to notice where things are hurt and wounded and where there's lots of struggle, and because there's lots of that going on right now. There's wars and there's hate and there's shootings and there's forest fires and there's like all that kind of stuff going on. So not to deny any of it at all. 40 days and 50 days. That's all. That's what I'm saying. Is this like 40 days of suffering, 50 days of like overcoming it? 40 steps backwards, 50 steps forwards. That'll do you. Because it's good to see the balance in both, and it's and not to tip too far one way or another. So at this time of year, the humpback whales are back in our inlet, which is incredible. We're surrounded by sea lions. They keep you awake at night. The birds start singing at 4 in the morning. The plants are going for broke, and it's just like beautiful right now. And those are the little small things that it's worth noticing on a daily basis, because you don't often get the huge moments of joy. Like, there's been some of those as well, but you don't often get those huge moments. And it's not worth waiting. It's not worth going out there and going, okay, I'm just going to wait for this perfect story to unfold here, and I'm going to stake all of my commitment to happiness or the emotional canvas or the emotional palette of positive, joyful living. I'm going to stake it all on one thing, like, oh, the Leafs better win the Stanley Cup, and I'll just hold back until that happens. It's like, they're not going to win the Stanley Cup.
And
They never
keep
win the Stanley
waiting.
Cup. Don't invest yourself in that, But you might invest yourself in an Austin Matthews goal, because that boy can sling pucks, and you're just like, wow, look at that, and just that's probably enough. If you're investing in a Leafs Stanley Cup, that's not an Easter move.
I love the practice. I love talking hockey with you, as you know, because we each have our teams that we cheer for that seem to share a playoff lament of the last several years, anyway. But I love talking hockey with you, and I love the following the joy piece too, Chris. Where I'm sitting right now in my home, there's a probably 5 foot by 5 foot window, so I can see out into some yard space. There's a kind of cherry tree that is only, maybe 15, 16 feet away, 5 meters or so. And the birds just come and go in this tree. And it's like they don't seem to register in whatever way birds might register. Hey, behind that window, Tennyson's watching us. So I feel like I get this sort of uninterrupted glimpse of them. And there's such joy in it, in the spirit of small joy. I can sit down with the biggest of weights upon my shoulders in this chair, and something about staring off into that tree 5 meters away, and a bit of blue sky, or a bit of the neighbor's peach and apricot trees that have just passed their blossoming. Something in that just resets some of that joy platform. And that's strange language even, but just to notice, like, oh gosh, that I think some of my learning with this is joy is available. And there is a certain amount of commitment or practice or surrendering to, or just frickin' go for it, just welcome it, that to amplify that joy. And boy, I feel that in the way that you're describing too, Chris. It's not the only narrative. It's not the only practice. Hard things are happening all of the time, and always have been also. And maybe they're changing in what they are also. But I don't want to lose the narrative that joy also exists, and joy is available, inner, outer, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's a zero-sum game. There's lots of hard stuff going on in our lives right now, family-wise, health-wise. Like, there's lots of stuff happening that maybe even increases the imperative to find these little pieces. And the availability of it in microdoses is actually helpful. It's like, oh, thank God it's available in microdoses. Because if we're waiting for the big things, we're deferring our capacity to appreciate it and to take it on board. And I think neurologically, cognitively, emotionally, if we're saying, no, I'm going to wait for the big thing to celebrate, then what happens is neurologically, all the little sufferings and pains begin to form our pathways. And I think we then start looking for those things. We then start getting the whatever the dopamine hits from the stuff that brings us suffering. And this isn't, of course, in no way to blame people for their circumstances, of course. Right, I'm saying the same thing. It's like it's a full human life to appreciate it, but it can feel like when things are overwhelmingly despairing that there isn't joy available. And I think about Viktor Frankl's book, and I think about what sustains people in moments of the deepest human suffering and stuff. And it is like really noticing those tiny, tiny little things, and recommitting to life. Not a Pollyanna hope, not a toxic positivity, but a kind of resilient positivity. The idea that we need to surface it in order for it to sustain us through the things that are hard. And that all of those things can happen at the same time. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not like you're doing something wrong to notice in the moments of deepest despair that something beautiful just happened.
Christopher, once upon a time, I remember the phrase associated with you was optimistic to the point of ridiculousness.
Uselessness.
Uselessness, that's what it was. Okay. What's that got to do with who you are? How's that living in you?
Optimistic to the point of uselessness. By a client that kept hiring me. And in fact, the first time, the not the first time, but maybe the second time he hired me. And I said, what are we going to put in the job contract? And he said, I just need you to be you. We just need you in the moment. And that's nice. That's nice to be wanted and nice to be needed for just who I am. I'm increasingly trying. I think now that I'm 55, I can do that more and just sort of, when you hire me, you get me. And I'm not going to do things that I don't know how to do or I don't want to do or that aren't going to serve you. That will make me feel miserable. So I've lately been working with clients that are, kind of just needing what I bring, whatever that is, right? And I haven't been made any bones to say I'm your answer. I'm not your answer. I'm just me. This is what I do. This is what I'm interested in. This is how I usually end up helping people. And if that's not for you, then that's fine. There's lots of other people you can work with. And then part of that is that kind of optimistic to the point of uselessness. I think another way of saying it is you hear the common expression, I'm not a pessimist, I'm a realist, right? And so I reclaim that by saying I'm not an optimist, I'm a realist. In other words, there's lots of stuff we got to work on here in the world. There's lots of small things and lots of big things. And my experience has been that pessimism, pessimists, people who are in more properly kind of cynical about stuff, they're not builders. They're not people I feel like are contributing much to the conversation. The times I've had cynics involved early on in projects and stuff, mostly what they do is tear them down. They rob us of the resource that we need, which is a little bit the curiosity. I'm going to avoid saying hope because it's not hope per se, but it's the curiosity, the perseverance, the determinedness, the creativity that's required to get a thing going, to do a different thing. And this is to make a distinction between cynics and skeptics. There's that famous graph where you have two axes of hope and doubt, right? And the cynic is someone who's high on doubt but low on hope, and a skeptic is someone who's high on hope and high on doubt. Skeptics are great, like take it every single time, like push our ideas, make us better, like because you believe in it. I feel like over the years I've worked in indigenous communities and many other places, and that I've been scolded so many times by elders and for mistakes I've made or things I've said that were wrong. And what I learned, because it's easy to take shame on when somebody gives you a hard time for a mistake that you've made or something that you did unconsciously. And I do remember an elder saying, look, the reason people scold you is because they believe in you. If they didn't believe in you, they would just turn their backs on you and walk away. So if you are being scolded, you are being made better. And that's the kind of difference between cynics and skeptics. Like a cynic will just walk away and go like, I don't trust you. I don't believe in you. I don't think what we're doing matters. Turn away. But a skeptic is someone who says, hey, you're of value. You're useful. You're fundamentally a good person, and you just did a shitty thing, or you screwed something up badly, and I'm gonna take you down in front of everybody else because I want you to be better. It's a form of relationship, actually, and especially when I get it from elders and folks that are claiming power back into their lives and into their communities. Yeah, that's a good thing to listen to and to be and to recognize that in the moment it's a little hot under the collar. And gosh, yes, I'm going to have to atone for a mistake that I made. But wow, thank you for not abandoning me. Yeah. So that's what I think optimistic to the point of uselessness. I mean, the uselessness part was the joke, and the optimism is not exactly optimism in the sense of like, it's all going to be great. But I think that that's the more nuanced, if I describe it that way.
And we get to do that. We get to nuance these things over our lives, right? I think that's one of the big skills, actually, that maybe comes with a bit of age or maybe comes with a bit of experience, and not to equate that with bullshitting, by the way, because I think we can bullshit ourselves to death, right? But something about, turns out to live as a human being in whatever awake ways that we can, or attentive, alert, curious ways that we can, it kind of requires some restorying of who we are and who we think we can be with one another. Those are narratives that I super relate to.
100%.
How did you get to be such a big learner, Chris? One of the ways I think of you is big learner, always learning, always quite, or in the ways that I've known you, quite intensely curious, and a brain that is able to take in quite a bit, a brain and a body that's able to take in quite a bit. Brain, body, heart. I'm going to keep wanting to extend that list. How did you get to be such a learner, and were there people that sort of sparked you that way, Chris?
Yeah, my dad, 100%. I'm just a fruit off my dad's apple tree. I mean, he was like that too. He was just super curious about the world around him. He's an amazing man. I lost him 18 months ago, and so I've been reflecting a lot on what he meant in my life and what he contributed to, and hearing stories and I think, at this age, when your dad dies, you start to reflect on different ways that he raised you, and all the little subtle things that maybe he didn't hide too well, and you start to see, oh, maybe he was like a little. So at the beginning, from the very beginning, I mean, my dad was just the kind of person that was really curious about the world. He had a really big spiritual epiphany when he was 18 or 19. His kind of mystical download. He didn't talk much about it to folks, but I think it calibrated him to just appreciate everything. Like, I think he had that moment really early on in his life, and that everything was just delightful to him. Like, everything was curious, and he would be like asking questions and getting to know people, and he was really gregarious, and he would just, it was like a never-ending set of questions. So that's what I say is the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree. So I think just being raised by a man like that made me a curious soul. It doesn't always work that way, but definitely there was that. And I just had so many interests growing up. Like, I remember, like, he bought me a set of the Book of Knowledge, right? Which was essentially the internet of its day of the mid-70s, And so it's like, read this. It's like, you couldn't possibly read it. It was like 26 volumes of stuff, like in a little encyclopedia. But man, I just sit down and pull L off the shelf and start reading about lemurs and, leprosy and Lebanon and, whatever, luck and all of this stuff. And it's just like, that's, at one point in my life, I read The Glass Bead Game, which is a novel by Hermann Hesse, which is a story of a game that's not actually fully described. There's a lot in the story, but the game itself really appealed to me. And it's a game where you link ideas together. That's how you win. You link ideas together that are kind of impossible, like the ratio of a particular harmony in a particular passage of a Mozart's, sonata to the way in which one of the Austrian mountains is, like, it's just, you look like you link these things together, and that's a move. You score a point. And I often felt like that my brain would love that, a game like that. So I may be optimistic to the point of uselessness, and I also have a memory retention to the point of uselessness too, so that I can remember, that Garth Orange batted 313 in 1985 with the Toronto Blue Jays, but I can't remember what, I did on Wednesday.
I'm just going to appreciate that and throw in the odd random fact that I don't know why I remembered it. I had a particular orientation to numbers, I think, when I was younger. And it's some of what I got excited about, and it protected me a little bit too. But Bobby Orr, the great hockey player's birthday, March 20th. I couldn't name the year, but I can still name
Yeah.
the day.
Yeah.
And like, that just sticks in me. What the hey, right?
That's brilliant. And I think that curiosity is like, I mean, do you remember that time we were at Kirkridge Retreat Center in New York, and Christina Baldwin was on our art of hosting team, and she and I found ourselves at a World Cafe table, and the question that the team had put in the World Cafe was what's the one question that would sort of change your, I don't know, change your mind or change everything. What's the one question you could ask that would change everything? And I think the question we came up with was, what would it take for you to be more curious? Or why aren't you curious? Or what are you curious at? Something like that. But it was about that polarity that she talked about curiosity and judgment can't live together in the same mind. That is one of my adages that I take into my life. And it's like, when I see the judgment around me, or I feel it in myself, then the move is, how do I be more curious in this moment? And Christina and I so loved that question that we broke all the rules and we stayed together for the whole World Cafe. We didn't change anything. We broke all the rules. But I think if anything, like, the kind of optimistic to the point of uselessness line combines with that curiosity. If you're curious, then you're constantly exploring what's new, what's different, what else could we be? Another good Toka question. What else could we be? What could we also be? And that propels us forward, because we can only lean into mystery, really. I mean, you could walk away from it, I suppose, and be overwhelmed by the uncertainty of it. But if you're a mystery lover, and if you're in need of mystery, like, in other words, everything you've tried has failed you, then you need to lean into the unknown. And the gateway, you have to go through the door of curiosity. You can't go through the door of judgment. It closes up all the options before you've even put your backpack on. So getting in through the door of curiosity. I feel like I can bring that to people. I feel like I love asking the dumb questions to my clients. Why do you do things this way? Or who said that's how you do it? Or who else could we go learn from? And, you know, like just the really simple questions. We get the privilege of asking the stupid questions that maybe are unvoiced in a system or a group we're working with, but can actually lead us through that doorway. And it's genuine curiosity. It's not a trick. It's like, I'm really genuinely curious. Why do you not talk to each other now? Like, how, why is that happening? Yeah. Seems helpful.
When you ask a question like that, like, why are you not talking to each other? I imagine that you might have like six or seven guesses that go along with that, that actually adds to the curiosity. Like, it could be, why are you not talking to each other? Well, you know, Harold said this and it offended me forevermore. There could be some really important or significant moments there. But I imagine that when you're asking that question, when any of us are asking those kind of questions, there's a way that we're sort of internally appreciating, hey, there could be 33 things going on here as opposed to just one.
Yes, but I find that when I ask those questions without any of those guesses, that they seem to be really the most genuinely honest. Because I try to work pretty hard on not diagnosing situations, and also knowing, you know, from the complexity work I've done, knowing that we're always going to be acting with an incomplete view of the system. But when I see a pattern that I don't get, like, why is everybody mean here? You know, it's a naive kind of a question. It's naive. Genuinely naive questions are really helpful. And you can only be naive if you haven't drawn conclusions. Yeah. Otherwise, you're being duplicitous. So I try not to actually figure it out until I actually put the question. And I really don't mean it to be deceptive or trickery. Right. It's just coming at it from genuine curiosity. And that's a loaded question. Why are you so mean here? So it's not like an open-ended question always. It does have a, this is what I'm noticing. I just witness people talking to each other in a way that is not what humans tend to want to do. Well, why did you do that? What's going on here? And then we just get at the meat of things. And then we can also say, like, why don't we do things like this? Or have you thought about maybe going and talking to what was it the other day? The other day we were talking with a client who is a how could I say it? They work in the human services, and they're trying to figure out how to care for clients in a particular way and a particular form of efficiencies. And they had connections to one of the people on staff worked. Their sister works for an airline in customer relations. And I said, well, why don't we just go talk to the airline? I'm like, what? I was like, well, they have to deal with people all the time who are not getting what they need. And, you know, and it was just like one of those things where it was like, yeah, why don't we go talk to the people at the airline? So they all started reaching out to people that they knew in their lives that worked with people and trying to help them solve problems that were not related to the human services that were being developed. And it just, you know, it opens up lots of new pathways and inspiration to think about. But sometimes you need an outsider to come in and ask a naive question like that. Or, you know, someone else would be like, I knew we should have, you know, like it's speaking something that's already in the organization or in the team. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm appreciating that, Chris. And in naming I appreciate the clarity on, like, our job is not to diagnose. I think there's some old traps that come along with such a thing,
yeah.
But to have the inner orientation, that says, you know, people are being mean to each other here. And I can think of 12 to 14 or whatever reasons why that might be true without even needing to say those out loud, just an awareness within that says, well, I don't know. It could be all of these things. Could be that I had a shit breakfast or somebody had a shit breakfast. Right. But just knowing that there's some not knowing there tends to lead to, oh, a little bit of extra curiosity together. That feels like there.
Yeah, I think so. And sometimes you need to make, you know, Toku will call it a sword cut, right? You need to ask that question and sort of say, or make an observation that just cuts and says, this is what I see. Yeah. Why is it happening? You know, I mean, in this respect, and again, this all sounds very kindergarten-y. Why are you being mean to each other? But in this respect, I'm quite inspired by the work of people like Arnold Mindell, and the people who work with process work and deep democracy, and the way in which they create the space for us to actually lean into those things. People don't, I think, want to be that way with each other, and circumstances put us into that kind of struggle and fight all the time for lots of good reasons. And then sometimes we just get trapped there, and it's really about like, is there a way out here? Is there a possibility to come out here? Why are we doing this? What's going on? Like, speak it from the parts in the system that hold it. You know, that's the kind of, I mean, we see that with process work, like, who is holding the suffering? Who is holding the systemic oppression? Who is holding the anger that's here in the system? And what, and if, and especially in Canada, we just don't talk about those things. So, you know, especially giving a place to talk about that kind of stuff, those naive questions and those kind of relying on human beings generally want to be happy and working well with each other. That's what we really want. Like, none of us want to be creating things, you know, organizations, ideas, products out of hate. I just don't think that's what we want. So when we're end up in a situation where we're doing it, and I'm not a conflict resolver. I mean, I hate conflict. I'm completely conflict averse, but I do think, but I do love the depth, like, you know, and that's something you and I share, and I think have supported each other in practice over in many, many years. If we can get to depth, if we can get to, you know, you call it human to human connection, which I think is the essence of it. That's where the possibility lies for us to move past stuff. And especially I look at what's happening in the States and the frustrations I hear of people saying that every single conversation I have is polarized and in many cases politicized, and nobody's talking out of their heart. Everybody's talking out of a set of messages and lines, and it's all just very abstract and non-human. And in fact, in some ways, it is non-human. Like, it's stuff and ideas that's been fed to them by machine learning, by algorithms and by rabbit holes that they didn't even know they were going down. And so when we can get up and have a beer together and you know, put our hands on the table and go like, what the hell is going on? That's a whole different conversation.
Beautiful. Chris, I'm going to pull out a phrase from some part of our past that has lived along the way here. In some of our earlier days when we were hosting some of the Bowen Art of Hosting, so 3-4 day gatherings, and there was this pattern that we were starting to notice with each other and feel, and this was a phrase I remember from you. We spent 3 days together connecting and learning so that we can have the best campfire ever.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we do a day of action planning
And then that,
afterwards.
right?
That's
Because
the other
then
way.
it's all,
It's like,
everybody's ready now.
yeah. 3 days of learning together, the best campfire of your life, and then action planning. Well, the campfire is the thing. The campfire is the litmus test. The being together in community is the thing. And it's funny that, you know, everything we do leads to that moment, and then we are in that moment. And it's that's what we're all going for. That's what human community looks and feels like. I remember doing a work once with a friend, and we were working doing an art of hosting, a little kind of 2 day one, and it was crazy because the end of the last second day, the client decided they were going to bring in somebody that leads community choirs, right? Like, kind of a, there's a sort of a discipline here in British Columbia of folks that lead like community singing. It's not even choir stuff. It's just community singing. It's beautiful capacity. So these people travel around and they offer these little 1 day workshops, whatever. So at the end of our 2 days together, she came in and she was going to lead us through. She had like 25 songs on the list that, you know, starting with the very simplest thing any group of non-singers can possibly sing, and all going all the way through to levels of complexity up to this 25th song. I can't remember what it was. Four part harmonies and all this kind of stuff, rounds and everything else. And she started us on the first song just to see where we're at. Everybody was like, nailed that. Okay, so that's fine. And you got to remember, like, this is a group of about 30 people. We'd only ever met 2 days ago. She didn't even ask who can sing. Like, I love that. It's like, because everybody can sing. I believe in that. I believe there's a special portal to hell for music teachers that people away from music. I think it's like, wow. What the most evil thing you can do in the world is tell people they're not good enough to make music. So all the way all the way down, but she got like within 20 minutes, we were singing songs in like the bottom third of her list. And then we ended up singing the most complex song like within an hour. And she's like, this never happened to a group. I've never seen a group like just so tuned in and listening to each other. And we're like, yep, that's it. So it's part of like how we learn together, how we bring curiosity. Like when you activate what we did in those 3 day art of hostings and still do, I think is really activate the curiosity, not just the questions that we get to ask of each other, but the curiosity about the experiences I'm having. Like I haven't worked together with people this way. I don't know what's going on. I'm like so attentive. I'm leaning in. We always talk about leaning in. That's the outcome, you know? And it's like I find myself doing things now, whether it's in my consulting practice and organizations or singing in a choir or running this, you know, helping to run this little soccer club that we run, where the litmus test is there, is that's it, you know, this is the moment. It's not what we did that took us there, it's what we are feeling right now. That's everything we've done has brought us to this moment of feeling like, wow, just awe at human relationship and what it can be at its best. It doesn't always get there. There's never a guarantee, but I think we have a pretty good sense. I mean, when we talk about the art of hosting, we're not hosting a meeting. You know, I stood on the volcano in Hawaii being disabused of that notion, 300 meters away from Pele herself, and completely lost in hosting this big gathering that I was involved in. And about a year later, the elder of that gathering, and I shared the story with her about my breakdown and inability to really find the solutions and all that kind of stuff. And she said, yeah, you know, the mistake you made was sitting next to Pele's house, thinking you were the one that was hosting. Woo! I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. And that's a super powerful realization that what we're doing is yeah. I mean, I think once you have those experiences of being in human community, which seem increasingly less common, and especially since the pandemic, when we've been so used to now working this way virtually and not being in each other's physical presence, that we forget what it means to build something together and then to feel it, and then it's like, and then the culmination of it is an overwhelming feeling for me of gratitude and appreciation and joy. And it's temporary, it's fleeting, things change. Like it's not a goal. It's just here's a moment, and then we go on to the next one. And I think if you flex that muscle and that heart gets used to being opened, then it makes it easier to do that over time. And I don't know, that's maybe what I think this life is about. I might be wrong, but I'm too old to change.
What I love about that, well, interesting, first of all of that, but what I love about it, Chris, is there is an essence in that, and I think it's one of the things that you and I both appreciate and every now and then are able to articulate or dance with. But there's an essence of like a being, where there's an essence of practice. I can hear you naming some of that, and sometimes I like to play it at the level of, you know, like try to think at the scale of what's our field here, our field, the broader field. It's a field of facilitation, or it's a field of bringing groups of people together so that they can be smart and wise together. I have a few favorites that I use to try to create a narrative there. But in you know, if you dare to name our field and an encouragement or an essence via Chris Corrigan of what helps in this field now, from some wisdom learned and over the years, kind of thing. What would you name, Chris?
What a question.
For the future of our field, an essence of practice now.
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to, I mean, I've been reflecting on this word too, but I think it comes down to support. Like this is really, I think in everything I've done where I've been at my best, it's when I've been supporting other people. and made better by the support of others. But essentially, like, my happiest space is supporting other people. I'm just in that place now where, what do you want? What do you need? What have I got to give you? You know, and that kind of freely, like, it is that reciprocal kind of support. It's support that creates a mutuality, that creates a cycle, that begins a gift cycle, that, and then it just feeds itself, and you don't know who's doing what. You don't know where the support comes from, where, you know, what happens. So it's like, it's some, you know, you go through the world acquiring your gifts, you know, like honing them, shaping them, sharpening them, because other people have invested in you, and because other people have cared about you, and because other people have said you're worthy, and you've been scolded in public, and you've been taken aside, and you've been given secret teachings, and you've been given, like, you know, all, everything that makes you up as a person that's different from me, with your whole set of skills and your whole set of tools and practices and things that are useful for the human community, you know? And then you give them away. And so for me, that looks like, I call it support, you know? I put a little umlaut over the U because it's sort of like a, I have, there's a little hashtag, like, support is life, with a little umlaut over the U. And it comes from the phrase football is life, you know, because there's something about in soccer, in football, there's like everything that life is embodied in that game and around it. And that includes support. And so, but for me, support is life. So it doesn't just show up in football. It shows up everywhere, and it shows up in our field. So if you were asking about, like, in our field, I would say it's support. It's just freely giving what you've developed because others freely gave to help you do that. And as each of us gets older and we develop and we grow, you know, we grow in our personal ways, and I think we coddle and incubate a little gift for the rest of us, you know? And I don't know that it's always that easy for people to see that in themselves. I'm not sure I always see it in myself either, but I know I have something like that, and you do too. And everybody listening to this does as well. And it's not the same thing, which, thank God, you know, like, we all have a different piece to offer the whole, or to offer the bigger field, which doesn't diminish from who we are personally, or doesn't diminish from our personal things. We get to have those as well. So another one of those polarities. So, yeah, it feels like gifting is a word that could describe that. But gifting in Western culture tends to feel like a one way, direction. Like, I give something, you receive it, and then it's kind of over. Gifting in the rest of the world initiates a cycle of reciprocity, of relationship, of community, and of mutual support. And that's what I mean by support. So it has to initiate somewhere. It will initiate with a gift, either one you've received or one you've given, and then it just feeds itself. If you tend to the dynamic of it, if you see it as flow, if you see it as moving and dynamic, then support becomes an ethic. It becomes a way of life, and not just a thing that I do. It becomes literally support is life. And I think, you know, we start to see that around us everywhere. I start to see the anchovies moving in here into our little bay, and the seals coming, and then the sea lions, and then the killer whales, and then the humpbacks. And it's like, you can see the way in which things support each other. I mean, the anchovies get digested by a lot of different levels of the food pyramid, but there's nothing that isn't interdependent, and there is nothing that survives on this planet without the support of other things. And so tapping into that, I think, yeah. So it just comes down to support. Support is life.
I'm going to clap. That's good. Chris, this is a gift as I look at our time now, and maybe we'll tuck it in for today, but this is a gift to be able to continue to spend to be with some of our time together this way. I think uniquely to have like a little gift of an hour to think out loud and follow whatever arises here, knowing we're leaving out some stuff too. Oh my gosh, what a treat. So I definitely feel that. Big appreciations to you. When people want to follow you and find you and get more curious about you, how do they do that? Will you just say that out loud?
Yep, they can come visit me at chriscorrigan.com, which is my website. They can contact me, and we can set up a Zoom call, and we can have a chat about whatever's going on. They can come join our courses. We teach, my partner Caitlin and I teach a course in complexity called Complexity from the Inside Out, which full of tools and theory and practice and all kinds of interesting things. That's all on the website. And our Art of Hostings, we still run those, and we do them with organizations as we've done over the years, which I love. So like one of my highlights of my year is working with you with our shared clients. And also open enrollment ones that we do and we host here on the West Coast of Canada. So lots of different ways to get in touch. And then my blog is, you and I may be the only two bloggers left in the world, but you're mind-blowing the level of regularity and cycle that you put into it. But my blog has been documenting my journey as a facilitator and as a human in the world for the last 21 years now. So there's quite a lot of material and resources there. And I just invite anyone to come to the website and take what you need. There's a whole list of facilitation resources, everything freely given, and always happy to follow it up with a conversation and a story. So
Love it, Chris. Deep bow and a high five.
yeah, man. Thank you for inviting me into this. So
I'm going
great.
to pause our recording and you and I can chat for a minute and then I'm going to come back on, okay? Okay, I'm back to recording now, having said a nice goodbye with Chris and shared our appreciations, a little extra layer of all of that. And I accidentally ended the original recording, so I hope this works to add this on. I think one of the most important things for me with Chris, one of the most poignant things with Chris is there's such a deep love that I feel that he has for learning, for people. We talked about a bunch of that while we were on the screen together and listening with one another. I finished that call just wanting to be another additional layer or of learner in the joys that already exist within me, they'd go with that. There's a kindness with Chris that I've known for 20 years now, and that really is rooted in such a deep appreciation of life, of relationship, of curiosity, the things that we were speaking of in the podcast. So just a bunch of appreciation that I feel for Chris, the connector that he is, that we get to share together, the kindness, the generativeness. Oh boy, a bunch of topics that we didn't even get to that I know are part of our respective journeys, a generative simplicity that's part of it. I think, at the foundation, Chris has something in him, and I have some of this in me. We have it in others that we've been able to be with. There is an appreciation for the deeply human desires and qualities that most of us have. And to be able to link all of that into the work that we do or the convening that we do, there is such a supportive quality there. I love being able to explore the essence kinds of questions with Chris, being able to do that. And, sort of evolve our lives together. So all of that is to name Chris as a super important friend and brother and colleague and fellow learner together. I feel there's something in the world that comes alive when we're able to meet in such curious ways together. And what a treat to be able to explore some of that with Chris in the format of a little podcast here. So all of that, do check out his website and the oodles of materials that are there. Chris is just such a prolific creator and sharer in those ways. In terms of today, I'll wrap it up by saying thanks again for those joining and listening. Forwards welcomed, shares welcomed, comments welcomed, questions welcome. This blog, the Human to Human blog, and other writings are also available on my website at tennisonwolf.com. Glad to be continuing to create and name some narratives that matter here around our deep humanness and dare to connect those into the everyday of people in jobs and teams and committees and communities, the things that we do. I'm so glad to be part of one of the people and connected with so many others that are trying to recreate that narrative of how we do our good and our sharing in the world. Thanks for joining today.